In Midsummer Worthy, someone has beaten an aspiring writer to death. Man, what a drag. We're talking weird Midsummer writers.
The history of books.
And that homage to Psycho on this episode of...
Welcome to Midsummer.
Hello, and welcome to Midsummer, the podcast where we dissect all the mysteries, the murders, and the many weird things about the long-running hit TV show, Midsummer Murders. I'm your host, Eric Buescher, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Eileen Becker. Hey, Eileen!
Hey, Eric! Today we're talking about Written in Blood, the second episode of the first series. This has been one of our most requested episodes, so we're doing it! It originally aired March 22, 1998. It was directed by Jeremy Silbertson and written by Anthony Horowitz. Let's get ready for the writer's circle!
Spoiler warning, we will be discussing the events of this episode, including the identity of the murderer, so if you haven't watched it yet and don't want to know who done it, pause this and go watch it. We will still be here when you get back.
I knew there was something wrong.
Did you go into the bedroom?
Of course I didn't go in. You think I'm mad? I took one look and I saw him stark naked on the carpet with his head bashed in, and I started. Well, of course I didn't bloody go in!
So, she didn't go in?
We open in 1955 at a farm in Duro, South Ireland, and it's not even in black and white. Someone enters the farmhouse, wandering through the place until they find a gun on the wall. Picking it up, they carry it upstairs to where a sick man lays in his bed. The sick man says, "Hey, Liam, where you going with that gun in your hand?" 12-year-old Liam kills him and runs off. We cut to 1998, which would be modern day for this episode. And in the village of Midsummer Worthy, everyone is writing something. Gerald Hadley is working on a terrible spy thriller. Laura Hutton, and I just know I'm going to call her Lauren Hutton at some point in this episode, thinks about Gerald while writing a romance novel. Drama teacher and walking comb-over Brian Clapper writes a very pretentious play for his high school students, while his wife Sue is working on a delightful children's book with cute dragons. And over in her massive house, Honoria Lydiard works on the Lydiard family history, a family she believes is one of the most important families in British history. They're not. Honoria lives with her sister-in-law, Amy, the wife of her late beloved brother, Ralph. Honoria loved Ralph deeply and seems to hate Amy and pretty much everyone else. They're all members of a writer's group in the village, and at their next meeting, they discuss bringing in a published author to speak to them. Current bestseller Max Jennings is suggested, and Gerald says no, doesn't want him here. So, of course, everyone but Gerald and Laura vote to bring him in. When Max sees Gerald's name on the invitation, he immediately accepts. On the day of his visit, Honoria goes to Laura's antique shop and interrupts her crying to get her latest load of old issues of Navy News. She sees something in one paper that causes her to walk off with it without paying. She heads over to Gerald's place, but he isn't home because he is visiting with Amy and asking her to not leave him alone with Max at all. He knew Max from a long ago and seems afraid of him. During the meeting, there's a lot of tension. Max gives the least dynamic writer's talk I've ever seen.
And we've seen a lot.
Yes. Gerald asks him where he gets his ideas, and Max says, from his experience as a psychiatrist before he was a writer. At the end of the night, Amy and Honoria try to leave with Max, but he turns around and goes back into Gerald's house, asking him for a drink. Later on that night, Laura watches Gerald's house from the bushes and sees Max drunkenly stumbling out and driving off. She also sees Brian Clapper return home from some secret outing. Brian sees someone walking towards Gerald's, but hides so he doesn't know who it is. The next morning, Gerald's cleaning lady finds him naked and beaten to death on the floor. She starts screaming because she knows she's going to be the one to have to get out those bloodstains. Over at the Barnaby homestead, Tom is grumpy because there have been no murders for him to solve, like a total psychopath. Cully stops by on her way to perform Shakespeare in Poland and asks him to watch her cat, Kilmowski, who is so cute, I really hope they will keep him around and not use him for some cheap side plot. Thankfully, Barnaby is called into the murder scene. Bullock tells him that Gerald was killed by the first blow, but the killer apparently just kept on going. Gerald's car is missing, as are all the clothes in the closet. Mrs. Bundy, the cleaning lady, also tells them that she found the one photo Gerald had of his wife hidden away. The wife Gerald never talked about with anyone, apparently. Barnaby and Trey first go to visit Sue Clapper, who fills them in about the group, Max Jennings, and the tension between Laura and Gerald. She sends them to Brian, who is out of school with his terrible drama class. Seriously, I cannot express just how bad that class was. Schools are burnt to the ground because of classes like that. Anyways, he tells them about seeing Honoria at Gerald's place the previous afternoon, but not about his late night excursion. What a scumbag.
Scum! Scum! I had to do that.
Of course. Next, it's off to Gresham House, the big old house where the Lydiards live. Honoria claims she was visiting Gerald to get money for the food for the group, then tries to throw a raid around, which amuses Barnaby to no end. Amy says that Honoria has let her live there since Ralph died, and that she was supposed to keep Gerald away from Max. They head to Max's place, but he's apparently in Denmark on a book thing, according to his very drunk wife. Barnaby tells Troy that Gerald's house was a blank slate. No mementos. No clues to who he really was as a person. Barnaby goes home to cuddle the cat and ponder the Gerald question, while Brian sneaks out for another late night trip. Little tourist info, this is our first time back to Midsummer Worthy since we stopped by during a discussion of The Maid in Splendor, which I'm shocked we have not been back sooner, as it is a setting for classic episodes Strangler's Woods, A Worm in the Bud, Death and Dreams, The Green Man, Down Among the Dead Men, and Death in Chorus. Hey, we should probably do a couple of these. Midsummer Worthy is the home to a writers group, as we see in this episode. It also has a competitive chorus, the Mercy Park Open Day Festival, a cricket team, a serial killer, and a group of creepy murder kits. However, if you want to shop for some antiques, you should probably go somewhere else because the store is closed. The village has not been seen since season 9, so I assume it's been sucked up into a hellmouth.
Now, standing in for Midsummer Worthy for this episode only is Aldbury in Hertfordshire. Since it is in a conservation area, it is a popular filming location, including the beginning of The Dirty Dozen, the Walter Matthau movie Hopscotch, Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason, and episodes of The Avengers and Inspector Morse. It was also the village of Binwell in the 2012 Midsummer episode Murder of Innocence. According to Google Maps, it has not been sucked into a hellmouth. I did like that we've got some very nice village shots in this one, which they don't do quite as much because I assume they're like extremely expensive to do.
Well, also because then people would probably realize they always use the same five villages.
Yeah. Yeah. Cinematography does a lot of establishing the sense of place in this episode. There's that nice establishing shot that shows that Gerald's house is reflected in the window of Brian's house as he's writing a scumbag lines, so that you get, and it's very important that you know that these are across the street from each other. So,
and I also liked it, like in the openings, like one of the opening shots, not in Ireland, when you actually get to Midsummer Worthy, like one of the opening shots is just a tractor running through, like guy driving his tractor through the village, which is like, yeah, that's a bit more like, you know, village life, like we think of it, which is not really probably village life nowadays.
Maybe. I live in a small, well, not really. We get the occasional tractor.
Okay. Is that what you're driving nowadays? Nice John Deere?
Yeah. No, my second car is not a John Deere.
Your first car is. So let's talk the writers group. Is this our first theme town?
It seems like it.
I mean, it's the second episode, and already, again, this is a town full of people all doing the same thing. Although I do feel like writers, a lot of people have that ambition to be a writer. I think a lot of people feel like, oh, writing is easy. I have a story to tell. I can write. Mm-hmm. Eileen and I, by the way, both work for a major publisher. And I'm going to tell you right now, it is not that easy.
It's not that easy.
It really is not. So what do we think of these books they're working on?
I'd read the kids' book.
Oh my God, that was so cute.
The
few cute dragons we see, I was like, yeah, that's a great kids' book.
Yeah, I really wanted that one to exist in real life. Hector the Dragon.
Although it really should be called Mother of Dragons now, right?
But the rest of them... The Lydiard family history is going to be read by one person, and that's the person who wrote it.
And you got the spy thriller, the romance, and then whatever the hell scumbag is.
Yeah. Actually, the romance writer, you know, romances are hugely popular right now. She could be very famous, you know, if she were writing these days.
Although I don't think she ever finished it.
Nah.
I'm pretty sure no one's ever going to pick up that spy thriller that Gerald was working on to finish that one.
No.
Brian, in the middle of that meeting, just is like, he thinks writing. I love that this thinks writing is elitist.
Yes.
Like Brian is this weird, super, like, I mean, Brian Clapper is the most artiste of them all, right?
Yeah. And he is the ultimate scumbag.
And his play, like, couldn't even understand what that play is supposed to be about or why he would want a bunch of like 15-year-old kids to do it.
Yeah.
So fun fact. So when they're in the writers group meeting, right? And they're talking mm-hmm. about like writers to bring, they mention, of course, Seamus Heaney, the great poet and translator. And they also mention Frederick Forsyth, the best-selling espionage writer, as authors they would consider to invite. And so according to the Midsummer Wiki, Forsyth enjoyed it so much that he wrote about it in his Daily Express column at the time. He deliberately misnamed Midsummer Worthy as Midsummer Jockstrap, and he described mm-hmm. the whole series as amiable tosh. Fair.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that they all the writers they do mention are real. Alan Bennett is real. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Archer, who Honoré considers vulgar, is real. Jilly Cooper, I did have to look up because I was not familiar with her. Mm-hmm. I don't think she's had much published in the U.S., but she is also a romance writer, which is why Laura mentioned her.
No, it was very interesting, grounded, and I did mm-hmm. kind of love the sheer balls on this writers group. Yes, let's ask these massively best-selling authors.
Yes.
They will come to our piddly little town.
Yeah, bestsellers, award winners, you know, people who've won Booker Prizes. Sure, they're going to come.
What's their honorarium?
Yeah.
You got a speaker fee there?
Yeah. And how many people are going to be there? Six?
They get Max Jennings, for reasons we will discuss later on, who gives like one of the most low energy writer's talks I've ever seen in my life. Just like, writers need stamina. I was like, where's yours, Betty?
Yeah. As part of our jobs, Eric and I do go to writer discussions and talks at various mm-hmm. things. Some writers you listen to and you wonder how they ever make it out of their house and function. Some are absolutely amazing speakers. Max fell on the low energy end of things, shall we say?
Well, it's weird. It was like, you know, Max was a former psychiatrist, and you feel like he's giving a writer's talk like he was talking to some patients.
Yeah.
Which some of them probably needed.
Yeah.
Also, I have to say that the author photo on Max's book was clearly the actor's headshot and did not look like any author photo I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Since they're all trying to get published, Eileen, why don't you take us through the history of books in your history corner?
All right. This is a subject that is near and dear to both Eric and me. So, storytelling is probably as old as language and possibly older. It definitely predates writing, and our oldest tales were passed down through the generations through oral storytelling traditions. Eventually, the tales were written down onto clay tablets. The vast majority of these tales have been lost, sadly. But a fire in the Royal Library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh preserved around 30,000 clay tablets from the last days of the Assyrian Empire. Included in this were fragments of the Sumerian, the Epic of Gilgamesh, written around or before 2100 BCE. This epic is considered one of the oldest surviving, or recovered, pieces of literature in human history. Prayers, lists of kings, religious texts, instructional works, and legal codes are also among the oldest texts inscribed on clay tablets or engraved into stelae. In Egypt around 3000 BCE, papyrus scrolls were beginning to be used to record works of mathematics, medicine, and architecture, as well as religious texts such as the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Papyrus was a thick paper-like substance which was rolled up into scrolls, and the writing was done in columns which unfolded as the papyrus was unscrolled. This method was used until the 8th century of the Common Era. The oldest written language systems were the Egyptian proto-hieroglyphics and cuneiform, used in the Sumerian and Akkadian languages from around 2600 to 2700 BCE. Most of these early written languages developed in the Fertile Crescent, the Nile Valley, and the Mediterranean. The oldest written Chinese language found dates from around 1250 BCE. On the Indian subcontinent, the Indus script is an undeciphered series of symbols that may or may not have constituted a written language, used from 2700 to 1900 BCE. The Hindu religious text, the Vedas, written starting around 1500 BCE, were written in Vedic Sanskrit. The oldest parts of the Bible date from the 12th and 13th centuries, while the Iliad and the Odyssey date from the 8th century. The oldest libraries date to the oldest text, as they were storehouses of the clay tablets inscribed in cuneiform. Correspondence, religious texts, and bureaucratic documents were kept for reference and to teach scribes. The texts in the aforementioned Royal Library of Ashurbanipal are crucial to understanding ancient history. Other key ancient libraries include what we call the Persepolis Fortification Library in Iran, the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, and the Library of Celsus in Ephesus in Turkey. All were eventually destroyed by various conquerors or fell into ruin, though some texts were saved or preserved. While vellum and parchment, both made from animal skins, replaced papyrus in Europe, in China, paper was invented around the 1st century CE. The knowledge of papermaking was passed to the Islamic world through two Chinese papermakers who were taken prisoner after the Battle of Talas in 751 CE. In the 13th century, papermaking spread to Europe. The Chinese also developed woodblock printing on fabric before 220 CE and later on paper by the 7th century. This method was used until the 19th century. In Mesoamerica, texts were written on animal hides or paper made from agave fibers from the 3rd century CE. They were then folded between wooden covers to protect them in a form called a codex. Nearly all the Mayan codices were destroyed by the Spanish invaders. The codex was also used in the Old World, starting in China and moving eventually to Europe. The Romans used a wax tablet, which opened like a modern book, with a stylus which was used to inscribe characters. Scrolls eventually gave way to folded papers that became bound on one side. These were still handwritten, however, giving rise to the beautifully illustrated manuscripts of the Middle Ages. But copying errors were frequent, manuscripts were expensive, and knowledge was kept in the hands of a very small elite, mainly religious. Woodblock printing spread throughout Asia, and ceramic and wooden movable type blocks were developed in China around 1041 by a commoner named Bi Sheng. Metal movable type soon appeared as well. However, woodblock remained the predominant form of printing. In the mid-15th century, papermaking had become cheaper, and a new type of indelible ink had been developed by a German goldsmith named Johannes Gutenberg. Gutenberg needed that new ink for his brand new movable type printing press, an invention that would soon spark a religious revolution called the Protestant Reformation. The era of the modern book had begun. With improvements in technology, books became cheaper and easier to make. Literacy rates began to increase as writing was no longer the sole purview of the religious houses. Long-form narratives, always popular in oral traditions and in royal courts around the world, became even more popular. There is debate over what constitutes the first novel, with some citing Murasaki Shikibu's Tale of the Genji from early 11th century Japan as the first. Miguel de Cervantes satirized the medieval chivalric romance in his 1605 work Don Quixote, considered by many to be the first modern novel. The Enlightenment was possibly the first information age, as so many books were published. Chapbooks were small, cheap books that were widely sold. Paperbacks came along in the mid-19th century, a product of the industrial age. They were cheaply and quickly made and often sold at newsagents at railroad stations. They were often referred to as penny dreadfuls, pulp fiction, or dime novels, depending on the place and time. Pocketbooks, a publisher of small paperbacks that we now call mass-market paperbacks, came along in the 1940s. Audiobooks, recorded on vinyl, were developed in the 1930s as part of a government program for blind readers. It wasn't until the 1980s that they started to be sold in retail bookstores, as cassettes and then as CDs. They are now almost exclusively downloadable electronic files. Computers have drastically changed reading habits, as more books are created, edited, stored, and read electronically. The Amazon Kindle debuted in 2007, and the ebook soon grew in popularity. Many types of books that used to be printed now exist almost exclusively electronically on the internet. It's much easier to update an online encyclopedia than a printed one. Still, many readers are devoted to the physical book. The smell, the texture of the page, the ease on the strained eyes, and the comfort that you're holding something real. It continues to be a wonderful object.
I have way too many of them.
It's a hazard of our job, which is a hazard of our love of books.
Yes, more of an addiction, really.
Yeah.
Why don't you take us into the cast this week?
All right. Well, there's a lot of return visitors in this one. So we start with Joanna David, who played Amy Lydiard. David is a previous Village star for her work as Mother Julian in the episode A Sacred Trust.
Did not recognize her at all. I looked at the photos of Sister. It was like unrecognizable almost.
She really is, until I think around when she gets the money, and then I like there's she gets a bit of a backbone, and there I see Mother Julian.
Yes.
Yes.
There's the Catholic.
Yeah. Joanna hails from Lancaster, appearing in her first major TV role in a 1971 production of Sense and Sensibility. She went on to roles in War and Peace, Rebecca, Bleak House, Miss Marple, Foyle's War, and most recently in House of the Dragon as Lady Jocelyn Redwine. She's been with actor and Midsummer murderer Edward Fox since 1971 and is the mom of Amelia Fox and Freddie Fox. David Troughton was Greasy Brian Clapper. Ugh. He also shows up in The Animal Within. Troughton is the son of Patrick Troughton, best known as the second Doctor Who. In fact, some of David's earliest on-screen work was in small roles in his dad's series. Since then, he's built a long career on stage and screen, appearing in Richard III, Wings, A Very Peculiar Practice, New Tricks, Inherit the Wind with Kevin Spacey, and The Archers. In 2011, David played his father's Doctor Who in two plays, keeping it in the family. He has two children who are also actors, Sam Troughton, who we discussed in Crime and Punishment, and William Troughton. He's also the uncle to actor Henry Melling, better known as Dudley Dursley. John Shrapnel was great author, terrible psychiatrist Max Jennings. He also appears in Death and Chorus. Shrapnel was a member of the RSC and the National Theatre for years and appeared in a number of productions. On screen, you might recognize him from Notting Hill, 101 Dalmatians, Nicholas and Alexandra, Gladiator, Troy, and Alien Autopsy. A classic. He passed away in 2020, sadly. And yes, he is related to Henry Shrapnel, who is the person that gave us the term. Yes, Shrapnel. Jane Booker was stalkerish Laura Hutton. Not Lauren Hutton, Eric! Who is a completely different person who we will never talk about because she did not appear in Midsummer Murders. Jane, however, was also in The Creeper. She's been a regular in Nanny, not that one, First Among Equals, Don't Wait Up, and Finding Neverland. She's also a regular guest star on a lot of British TV. She's married to the actor James Fleet, who was also a return visitor on Midsummer. Una Stubbs was great drinker, poor swimmer Selena Jennings. She is also in The Dagger Club. She's probably best known for playing the character Rita Rollins in both Till Death Do Us Part and its sequel In Sickness and in Health. She's also in Wurzel Gummidge, Give Us a Clue, Keeping Up Appearances, and The Catherine Tate Show. Younger viewers will know her as Mrs. Hudson in the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock. She actually knew Cumberbatch when he was 4 because she worked with his mother, Wanda Ventham. She was married and divorced twice, and we discussed her second husband, Nicky Henson, when we talked about They Seek Him Here. She passed away in 2021.
I want to say, how much fun was she in this? I mean, it's basically a glorified cameo.
Yeah.
But she's drunk. For both of her scenes, she's drunk. And that leap into the pool with all of her jewels on.
Yeah. Her line readings are great.
Yes.
You know, when she says, you know, when he asks if it's too early, you know, for that, you know, obviously a drink. And she just says, I'm awake, aren't I? Timothy Bateson was Guy really overdoing it as Dickensian lawyer James Jocelyn. He's also in Death's Shadow and Orcus Fatalis portraying Jocelyn. In 1955, he appeared in the first English production of Waiting for Godot. He has a long on-screen career dating back to the 40s. He appeared in Nicholas Nickleby, The Mouse That Roared, Ring-a-Ding Rhythm, The Italian Job, Grange Hill, Labyrinth, and his final role before he passed away in 2009, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, as the voice of Creature, the house elf. Bateson was a voice actor on the show Tugs, playing a character named OJ.
It was a tugboat, not a white bronco. he was so overdoing it, and I loved it.
Yeah.
I was like, he sounded like Dracula at one point.
It's such a Dickensian character, that kind of that lawyer, and he plays it just as, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, as he should.
Of Jocelyn Tibbles and Delele.
Marlene Sitaway was our screaming Mrs. Bundy, and she did a great scream. Now, she had appeared in a small role in The Killings of Badger's Drift. Then she appeared in this episode as Mrs. Bundy. She also plays Mrs. Bundy in Death's Shadow and would go on to play a different character and get stabbed to death by a little girl in Judgment Day. Outside of Midsommar, she appeared in Coronation Street, Hunting Venus, All Creatures Great and Small, and most recently in the film Alleluia.
I believe Alleluia, written by the previously mentioned Alan Bennett.
Ah, that is, I think you're right. But anyway, in case you didn't get it, she did not go into the room. Brian Parr played Mr. Baker, the cab driver. He has roles in Picture of Innocence and Talking to the Dead. He's a retrograd and trained at the RSC in a lot of roles he describes as killers and clowns. Shame he didn't appear in the clown episode. He's appeared in Shoestring, Blue Ice, and The Brief. Neil Conrich was Police Constable Angel. He's appeared in 6 other episodes as Angel. Guess he never got his spinoff. Maybe if he had been a hot vampire. He also appeared in The Brief, Bad Girls, Wallander, and Reuniting the Rubens. Looks like he is now a managing director at a voiceover agency. This is also another point of connection with the film Hot Fuzz, whose main character, played by Simon Pegg, is Police Constable Nicholas Angel, promoted to sergeant in the film. Can we get Edgar Wright on this podcast, maybe? Or is that like...
Probably not, but God, that would be fun. Actually, I think he'd probably do it.
And not because we knew him in a former life under a different name. Now, shout-outs to Paul Putner and David Maybrick, who played policemen in this episode. They've appeared in several other episodes, including The Killings of Badger's Drift. These guys fill out that world of Midsommar.
Yes. Some regular cast highlights of non-returning visitors. So Judith Scott was future divorcee Sue Clapper. She also goes by Judy Scott, probably because there's an American actress named Judith Scott. She won a Best Actress Award at the Cannes Television Film Awards, did not know that was a thing, for her role in an episode of a BBC Screen 1. I guess these are like, you know, anthology shows. Her episode was called Tell Me That You Love Me. She performed with Sean Bean. No idea how he dies in that one. She also played the character Sharon the Magician in a 1999 film called Virtual Sexuality. Here's the plot. Virgin 17-year-old Justine goes to a virtual reality exhibition with her geeky friend Chaz. There she encounters a virtual makeover machine where she uses to create a 3D image of her perfect man. After a freak power cut, Justine finds herself inside that male body, becoming her own ideal mate. Naming this alternative self Jake, he moves in with Chaz to try to come to terms with being a teenage boy. Jake then realizes that an unaltered version of Justine is still around, unaware of Jake's existence. This Justine falls for Jake, unaware of how messed up this is. Jake fends her off by feigning interest in the infamous local man-eater known as the Hoover. Justine then decides she must lose her virginity at any cost and dates the arrogant Alex to achieve this. As the big date looms, Chaz and Jake attempt to thwart Justine's plan, and she eventually realizes she prefers the unthreatening Chaz. I love 90s films. Oh, and she did a bunch of Mike Lee stuff. Robert Swan played Ugly Lady with Great Legs, Gerald Hadley. He had over 35 years of screen work, and apparently his most recognizable role to American audiences was playing the vicar in The Witches and the Grinnygog. Yeah, I never heard of it either. He is in a couple of straight-up classics, the Malcolm McDowell film If, directed by the late great Lindsay Anderson, and the Madness of King George, and he's also in the original stage version of that. His last regular role was in Night and Day before passing away in 2006. Anushka Le Gallois played Bouncing Barbara Neal. I am not proud about that. She only acted for a few years performing in Bad Girls, Doctors, and Wizawig. Not really sure what she is up to nowadays. Nancy Loader played teen actress Edie Carter. Her first on-screen role was in 1993's The Lodge, and she would go on to appear in The Bill, The Brief, and The IT Crowd. I believe she has retired. She doesn't have a lot of credits lately. And I believe she is currently living in Sussex. Daniel Newman played her photographer brother, Tom Carter. His biggest credit is Wolf in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. He's also in The Borrowers, Ab Fab, and Hotel Babylon. He now runs a personal training business, it looks like, in London. John Barden played teacher who hated Troy, Mr. Belgrove. Barden was a character actor best known for 15 years on Coronation Street playing Jim Branning. He was also in Clockwise, Get Back, East is East, and Fierce Creatures. He passed away in 2014. Jay Barrymore was boy sharpshooter Liam. He only did a few acting roles, including Have Your Cake and Eat It, The Demon Headmaster, and Randall and Hopkirk, Deceased. So acting was not in his blood, I guess, but money was, because he currently works in finance, managing director at Accenture, which, according to online, it is a multinational professional services company based in Dublin, specializing in information technology services and consulting. It's a Fortune Global 500 company, reported revenues of $64.1 billion in 2023. We made 17 cents with this. So who made the right decision there? Also, you might know his name because from 2008 to 2010, he dated Emma Watson. You know, Hermione Granger. Murray Ewan played Liam's dead dad. He's a character actor who appeared in small roles in Bergerac, Stalin, Citizen X, and Kill Kill Faster Faster. And then Richard Parkin played mute director Brad, Cully's boyfriend? Maybe in an uncredited performance, probably because he has no lines. That might explain why they didn't have him say anything.
He's cheaper that way.
Yep. He's gone on to write and direct some short films, and he's also an author. Perhaps he should have gone to the writers group and not Poland. Now, our village star this week, I mean, it had to be Anna Massey as Honoria Blood and Bone Lydiard. She also appeared in Secrets and Spies. Massey had a career which included over 100 roles in British film and television. She is the daughter of the actor Raymond Massey and the actress Adrienne Allen, although she didn't really, her dad separated from her mom very young, so she didn't really have a lot of connection to her dad, apparently. So she had no formal training, but still one of the leading roles in the 1995 production of The Reluctant Debutante, and that made her a theater star. Around the same time, she had her first film role in Gideon's Day, which is directed by her godfather, the legendary John Ford. Now, she would go on to appear in the cult classic Peeping Tom and Hitchcock's first R-rated thriller, Frenzy. She won a BAFTA for her performance in 1986's Hotel du Lac. She also appeared in things like The Machinist, The Importance of Being Earnest, and Angels and Insects. She was married to the actor Jeremy Brett in the 50s and 60s. In her autobiography, she claimed that he left her for another man. And she is quoted as saying, actors marrying each other is not a good idea. To which Angelina Jolie responded, yeah, no shit. She eventually married metallurgist Uri Andress and passed away from lung cancer in 2011. Now, if there was anything that was going to seal her being the village star this week, it had to be the scene where she is chopping vegetables and shouting blood and bone,
which
was so good. And could have just been really dumb and over the top in another actor's hands. And just the intensity which she shows with that is just masterful.
The way she handles the character as we go on, you know that she's off right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about that afterwards. But you're not sure exactly how off until, you know, each scene goes by and she seems to build it. There's a way she develops this character as an actress that is just absolutely phenomenal.
I mean, even if you look at the way she moves as Honoria, mm-hmm. that she takes these kind of big strides, waving her arms, like it's a very clear choice of like, she knows how this character moves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this character moves the world, like chewing the scenery, even with her walk.
Yeah.
She was known for being a very well-prepared, deeply prepared actress. Who would like highlight multiple colors in her scripts of just things of just like, this is a pause. Mm-hmm. What kind of pause I want to do here? You know, like highlight repeated phrases. She was just known for deep preparation and it shows in this.
Yeah. And it's just a masterful performance. You buy every second of it.
We're going to take a quick break here and we'll be back with the second half of Written in Blood. And we're back. Let's talk about the second half of Written in Blood.
I promised Ralph I'd look after you.
It's not me you're interested in, Honoria. It's Ralph you want, and he's dead. Keeping me here won't bring him back.
Don't talk to me about Ralph.
He was my husband.
If you'd loved him enough, he wouldn't have died.
I'll leave tomorrow. It'll be better for both of us.
No, you're a Lydiard. Blood and bone.
What?
Blood and bone, that's what counts.
counts. Blood counts. Bone counts.
It's breakfast time at Coston Police Headquarters, and Troy interrupts Barnaby's one good meal of the day with the news that Gerald had previously reported his car stolen, but about an hour later than he had actually discovered it missing, which is weird. There's also no record of Max on any flights to Denmark or anywhere else. According to Max's secretary, Barbara Neal, or as Troy way too enthusiastically calls her, Bouncing Barbara, best-selling, jet-setting author Max Jennings went to the piddly Midsummer Worthies writers' meeting because he knew Gerald. She said that they were not friends, and in fact, Max was afraid of Gerald. But Amy said Gerald seemed afraid of Max, so what's going on there? Next, they decide to interview Laura with a glass of wine. After telling them about Honoria's paper theft, she tells them that she barely knew Gerald, and sure, maybe she harbored feelings for him, and she isn't judgy, but if he is going to have that kind of woman come to his place, it's at this point Barnaby asks her to explain what the hell she's actually talking about. So Laura had a thing for Gerald, until she waited in the bushes outside his home the night before the meeting. She saw a tall woman in cheap clothes and a funky walk pull up in a cab, and then enter Gerald's place and have a drink with him. Believing Gerald was having an affair with a woman of the evening, Laura was heartbroken. The night of the meeting, she went back to the bushes and watched Max leave. Thinking she would talk to Gerald then, she left when Brian Clapper pulled up. Well, that means Clapper lied about his alibi, so they head over to the school to talk to him again. Once he realizes he's busted, he says he went out for a wank. Walk. Went for a walk. Then he tells them he saw someone going to Gerald's, but never saw who. Later that night, Brian is called over to the home of his favorite student and object of his gross lust, Edie, and ends up sleeping with the poor girl, unaware that he's being photographed. The kids try to blackmail him for money, then they say this is just the new end to the play. Brian calls them scum, so they just blaster the photos all over town. Poor Sue. Joyce gives Tom a book report on Max's novel, which she says is beautiful. It's the story of a young Irish boy named Liam Hanlon, killed his sexually abusive father with a shotgun. Why is that familiar? Anywho, he runs off and meets an artist, and they travel the world together, and they make a fortune because of the artist doing paintings of the boy in various forms of historical dress. The book reads autobiographical to Joyce. Then Tom gets a call that they found Max Jennings' body. He's dead in a cottage by the sea, and Bullock says he was murdered the night of the meeting with a slow-acting poison. Troy thinks Max killed Gerald and then himself, but Barnaby does not. He wants to know more about Gerald, so they finally do a background check on their victim 2 days after he was murdered. Hey, guess what? They find nothing. No birth certificate. No wedding license. No work history. Nothing. So who was this guy? And why does he have 2.5 million pounds in the bank? That's what his solicitor tells them, and also that he was leaving 100,000 pounds to Amy in his will. Barnaby threatens to charge Barbara with obstruction unless she tells him the truth. Turns out she was sleeping with Max, and had been since she was his secretary for his psychiatry practice. The Denmark trip was a cover for a tryst, but Max was already dead when she arrived. She lied about discovering him to cover up their affair. Over at the Lydiards, Honoria says the paper she stole had a photo of Ralph's ship that she wanted. Amy is shocked about her sudden windfall. She's basically lived under Honoria's thumb. Honoria has all the money, and Amy has none. Well, not anymore. She tells Honoria she's leaving, and Honoria takes it about as well as you expect, by telling Amy that if she had loved Ralph enough, he would not have died. Classic Honoria. The cabbie who drove the woman to Gerald's house politely says she was an ugly woman who wore tons of makeup. Classy dude. Great legs, though. Barnaby realizes that the cab picked her up near a club for transvestites. He's figured out that Gerald was a transvestite, and he was the woman being driven to the house. He was attending the club when his car was stolen, and rather than having to report it there, he went home to report it. They track down the address to Gerald's London property, and it's a fancy place full of art and antiques. Barnaby realizes this is the place that Joyce described in Max's novel. Barnaby makes the first reveal. Gerald was Liam, the boy from the novel. He visited Max as a patient, and Max stole his life story for his book. Gerald didn't want to be left alone with Max, not because he was afraid of Max, but afraid of what he would do to Max. So when Max asked for a nightcap, Gerald served him one with poison in it. What Laura saw as Max drunk was him feeling the effects of the poison. But then who killed Gerald? Barnaby knows that one too, so we get the second reveal. Barnaby says that most likely Ralph died from AIDS. When Honoria found the paper, she saw a photo of Ralph and Gerald together in Turkey and went to talk to him so he could tell her about meeting her beloved brother. After failing in the afternoon, she went back the night of the meeting and found Gerald dressed in drag. Gerald, a little high on wine and murder, gleefully tells her that he slept with Ralph, which causes an already unbalanced Honoria to go off the deep end and beat him death with a candlestick. She stole all the dresses to hide who he was so it wouldn't lead back to Ralph. Barnaby and Troy hurry to the Lydiard estate, but it's already too late. Amy stumbles across Gerald's missing suitcase and clothes and realizes Honoria is a psycho. Probably the music copying Psycho is a big clue. Honoria chases Amy around the house with a big knife until Amy manages to hide in a locked room Honoria has kept from her. Turns out it's a museum about Ralph, featuring a mummified Ralph. Now ripping off The Shining, Honoria smashes through the door and comes at Amy, but Amy moves out of the way, sending Honoria through the window to her death. In the end, Barnaby returns home to find Cully there, and he informs her that the cat has to go because he is allergic. So the episode ends with the cat licking between its legs.
Kilmowski.
Yes. Now, before we go too further into this, I want to point out that the use of the term transvestite comes from this episode. Gerald never really gets a chance to kind of define who he is, and we only see him as a transvestite. Barnaby's the only one that kind of describes him as a transvestite. Gerald never really gets a chance to define his own gender identity. So I just want to clear that the terms that we are using are not that we are not the ones choosing these terms, that these are the terms that the episode has laid out. And that we, you know, they don't really kind of explain Gerald's sexual identity. Is he gay? Is he gay, bisexual, transvestite? Gerald is never the one who gets to identify himself.
No.
So let's talk about our killers, because we got two.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Honoria first. Now, we talk about crazy killers showing no signs of insanity. Not here.
No. she, like we said when we were talking about Anna Massey, you know right off the bat that this woman is not normal, that she's living in a bit of her own rarefied world that doesn't really acknowledge the existence of other people as humans.
Mm-hmm. There's only seemed to be one other human in her worldview, and that's Ralph. Yeah. Otherwise, she's kind of a monster and believes that she can just throw her weight around because she has money and just abuses poor Amy.
Yeah.
And, you know, even tries that stuff with Barnaby, and Barnaby's like, nope.
Excuse me?
But I also kind of like the way that Gerald sort of hissed at her when we get that reveal like at the end. I think everyone wants to do that to her.
Yeah.
What do you think of all the psycho homages in this one?
I had to kind of listen to the music. You're much more in tune with music than I am. But I did catch, because they were doing, you know, their standard kind of theme, but they were they were doing that kind of staccato high note as well through that scene, which is not normally there. And I think that seemed kind of very, much of a, she's a psycho and this is a psycho thing.
It's not quite the theme. It's definitely a riff on the psycho theme, but it's a riff that other films with like psychotic murderers have used.
Mm-hmm.
They also kind of used it in the previous episode of the killings of Badger Drift during the murder of the Rainbirds.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear when the knife comes out, they start playing that same kind of music.
Yeah.
But of course the big homage is the mummified corpse.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime you see a mummified corpse, you can't help but think back to Psycho. It's so part of the, pop culture, common language.
And I remember watching this episode for the first time and just shocked that did not see Ralph's corpse coming.
Mm-hmm.
And they very clearly hint at it because of the way the room is locked, but also the mention of that the house is so freezing, it's kept freezing cold all the time to keep, so it's like a morgue, but also keeps the body from smelling.
Yeah. Yeah. It's mentioned as a morgue several times, and it's mentioned as cold. I've been to England. It is cold everywhere.
And then, of course, there's the subtle ripoff to The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not subtle, Honoria smashes through the door.
Yeah.
Here's Johnny.
Yeah. I love that she removes any... In her previous appearance on or not, or the later one, chronologically, mm-hmm. where in Secrets and Spies, there's a sparkle to her and her eye. She has removed all sparkle from her eyes mm-hmm. throughout this entire episode.
I mean, even when she's honestly, she's when she dies, right? And mm-hmm. you see her body on the ground, which apparently some people say you can see her breathing still. But if she has a broken neck, she might still be kind of dying quickly. But man, she still looks grumpy and dead-eyed.
Yeah. She finally is dead-eyed.
It's the second episode in a row where the killer kills himself or gets himself killed before they are arrested.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting little trait there.
Yeah. It became part of the formula fairly quickly that the detective, whichever Barnaby, would confront the killer and explain it, and you would get some sort of confession. It's whether full confession or like whatever, prove it kind of confession. But for, the first two episodes, they do not get there in time to arrest the murderer before they are dead. So interesting.
They eventually Barnaby would start getting his man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that Troy describes their home as Frankenstein's castle.
Yeah. I think I found the home on Google Maps because I love like trying to find the locations. Mm-hmm. It looks to be a private home. There is no tag on it, that says, it's open to the house, but it is right outside of Aldbury. And it looks exactly like it with the way everything is set up. So
every time Honoria said Lydiard, I heard idiot.
Yeah. she was just, Anna Massey was just so perfect.
Yes. So killer number two, Gerald, his motive is revenge. And honestly, I think Max kind of had it coming.
Yeah. Talk about a major, unbelievably bad, I can't believe you actually did this, breach of professional ethics.
Yeah. It's a massive breach. And in the best-selling novel, and Gerald, and of course, Gerald doesn't want this to be his, like come out, but
yeah,
man, that was, and I guess Max maybe counted on that, but it's still but then it begs the questions, why would Max even agree to go?
And the thing that kind of confused me on this was, did he use his real name? Because we never learn what Gerald's real name is. So he recognizes the name Gerald.
Yes.
Gerald Hadley.
Exactly.
So, when did Liam or whatever Liam's name was, that was, if it was different in real life than the book, And I assume he would have told Max this during their therapy sessions, but when did he change his name to Gerald?
Yeah.
There's a lot kind of unanswered in that.
Well, yeah. there's a lot of this story. So let's jump back for a second. So they kind of dance around this a little bit, but was Liam the victim of a pedophile and became rich because of it?
That's what it sounds like.
Right. It's not quite clear, and I think maybe they kept it clear because it was a little he and the artist, they travel the world, and it turns into this beautiful novel. And I'm like, that sounds like something out of a NAMBLA website, right?
Yeah.
It was what was it? And then Max steals his story mm-hmm. and then goes and visits him for no reason. Why did he go back in?
Yeah.
I was like, sorry, buddy.
Yeah. I mean, what can he say? I mean, it's very clear that that Gerald hated him. Mm-hmm. I mean, his reactions, through the entire time we see him, at the end of the writer's group meeting, he is just sitting there impatiently waiting for this to end and wants Max out of his house.
And then, of course, he goes in and goes, can I get a nightcap? And he goes, oh, yeah, I'll get you a nightcap. Why would you drink that? At best, he's spitting in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would not drink that at all.
Yeah.
How did they not find that big bottle of poison that was just in his cabinet?
We never kind of learn about what happened to it. They never find it. It's mentioned that he's poisoned, but we don't know what happened to it. I wonder why, I mean, because they mentioned that the writers group ends at 10:15.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's leaving. He has some time long enough for Laura to think that Max got drunk, you know, he had enough time to have enough drinks to get drunk. So why is Gerald getting dressed up to go out in women's clothing? He doesn't have a car anymore, so he can't be going to.
Maybe it's, I kind of was like, is it the saddest, again, by the way, psycho homage, but yeah. Maybe it was the, I was thinking that maybe it was, well, that's why I was thinking, it was like, if Gerald is truly trans, right? If he's like not a transvestite, but trans,
mm-hmm.
and is more comfortable as a woman, mm-hmm. He might be sort of celebrating what he sees as his victory over the person that wronged him.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
But because this is 1998, they don't really, you know, they don't really have, like, there's probably at this time, like for these writers, like transvestite and transsexual are probably interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
They don't quite make it clear. But yeah, it's very confusing. Again, also, so that big bottle of poison, why is it in the cupboard right next to the sink where the glass?
I assume he bought it ahead of time.
For funsies?
Well, no, I assume he bought it once he knew that Max was going to come.
Uh-huh.
And then he hid it, I guess, where Mrs. Bundy, the housekeeper, wouldn't find it. That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Max also is apparently very visibly breathing when he is supposed to be dead in that bed. I also, the way they position the painting,
mm-hmm.
very, it's in the foreground, quite easy. Like, Barnaby stops and stares at it, and then it's just like, oh, it's that kid from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Cully.
Yeah.
Also, they kind of foreshadow the Ralph's death of AIDS, that when you go into the transvestite club, there's that big board that we see that has a lot of information about HIV and AIDS.
Yeah.
So again, this is the kind of the idea of the fair play mystery. All the clues are there.
Yeah.
Like everything is out. It's just how you piece it together.
Yeah. And it gets tricky because we do have two murderers
mm-hmm.
with different motives.
Exactly. So that Navy newspaper where they see that she sees the photo of those two. Why would a Navy newspaper have these photo of these two guys who look like they're going on a Hawaiian vacation? One of them has a lay.
Yeah. I mean, it's maybe the Village People Navy News. Who knows?
Yeah, that's what it's like. It's in the Navy News. I also kind of liked what Laura's statement about her feelings towards Gerald and like that realization. I kind of love that. I always believe you love something hard enough, they would love you back.
That is a very
romance novel.
Romance novel feel. I think there's a certain amount of it that is real for people. You know, they think that this will really happen if they love somebody, which is why people end up in very toxic relationships and people become stalkers and justify their stalking by, you know, and the whole don't take no culture that if you try hard enough or if you work hard enough, that person is eventually going to come around. And it's a trope that's like,
yes,
obviously overused in a lot of, and not just romance novels, in a lot of type of novels. And fiction and TV shows and stuff.
Hey, can we just talk for a second about the sad looking dog in the intro?
Aw. We get a sad dog and a cute cat. It's kind of like a perfect. They
covered their bases.
Cat. Yeah, yeah.
So, as I put this in my notes, Brian Clapper, ugh, we have to talk about this guy.
We do. We really do.
So. First off, I have to say this, and maybe you feel differently. I don't understand what the point of that entire subplot was.
This is a very full episode because they're basically, with two killers, this adds a third major plot to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives Patrick Troughton the creepiest role of his career, as far as I can tell, because I can't imagine any of his other roles being this creepy. And he does, by the way, he does a great job with this role.
Oh, he is fantastically creepy and gross in this.
Yeah. That laugh he has developed for the character is
the giggle. It's a giggle.
Yeah.
His sweatiness, the comb over was just, but it's all gross.
Yeah.
But it kind of just detracts from everything because it's not really essential. And it really just becomes, so like if you look at like the Liam backstory and this story, in this you have incest, pedophilia, potential pedophilia, statutory rape.
Yeah. And Honoria having a very unhealthy relationship with her brother.
It's like we've talked about this in the past, like the ick. Like I don't think this goes to the levels of Masterclass in the or Night of the Stag in the ick, but it's broaching it very carefully or very 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 closely.
Yeah.
So let's just take a step back here. So he's the cool teacher, I guess. Letting the kids, Edie gets to call him Brian. He flirts with her, and like even the kids all know that like he's gross.
Yeah. Oh, they know he's totally gross, and they're playing with him this whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. When with the interpretive acting, it was just like, God.
And we all had that kind of cool teacher that was really gross.
How did he forget his boxer shorts?
I don't know how you forget that. Yeah.
Also, which also means, just think about this one. He was commando at some point in this episode.
Yeah.
So the kids want 5,000 pounds from a guy who's barely middle class teacher.
Yeah.
They're not the smart kids, right?
No. If you're going to, like, there's a great scene in one of the Simpsons episodes where they figure out how much Skinner makes per year, and that over a lifetime he would have over $1 million. So they think he's a millionaire. I kind of feel like it's that kind of level of mathematics that they're doing. And that math, I think, was done by, Bart and Milhouse.
But then, it's just the final scene of the play?
Yeah.
So are they blackmailing him or not?
It's weird because I never quite figured that out. And then they just go ahead and post all the icky pictures anyway.
Which
the person I feel... Yeah.
Sue.
Yeah. The person I feel sorry for is Sue. Because Sue is a really nice person who's writing a really lovely children's book about a dragon named Hector. Yeah. And I want to read that book.
Then he's like, as soon as they, like, it's the end of our play, he's screaming at them and calling them scum. And I'm like, they have photos of you having sex with a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah. Laugh it off again.
You weirdo.
Yeah.
We all had to see the photo of your bare ass.
Yeah.
He gives a great performance in a thing that's like, I feel like they were doing it to kind of flesh him out, but I didn't want him fleshed out. I don't need him fleshed out. Like just the scene where he's talking about Edie to Troy and Barnaby, and you can see Troy's reaction of just like, you are gross.
Yeah.
That's all we needed.
And they never explain what he's doing when he goes out at night, but he's going.
He says it. He says it as he says it as a mistake.
Well,
he went out for a wank.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And he's parking outside Edie's house. I'm like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That you don't say. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he can wank off in his bathroom, you know.
Well.
But he needed to be in proximity to Edie.
Look, you don't know his routine. Sue could be a very light sleeper. That whole thing, it's like, it's the first Midsummer ick.
Yeah. After the, I guess, the...
Rainbirds. I guess they had some ick right at the top.
Yeah, there's always been ick. The Rainbirds and the you know...
It's how they balance the ick, and this is a little too heavy on the ick.
But not... it doesn't cross over into Masterclass, Night of the Stag ick. Yeah.
No. But it's still pretty ick.
Yeah.
And my last comment about him is, like, when he just gets out of the car and just, like... pastes his comb over. I'm like, just get a hat, man. Just get be the first guy in Midsummer. Well, no, the first guy in Midsummer with a stupid hat was in the first episode. So be the second guy in Midsummer with a stupid hat. Strange kill in this time, I guess, is naked bludgeoning.
But he wasn't naked at the time.
So she bludgeons a guy dressed in women's clothing and then strips him naked. I Yes, that's strange.
Yeah. It's very kind of normal as far as killings are concerned in British mysteries. Yeah.
Yes. So detective work in this episode. So number one, I want to point out that halfway through we get the clue recap, which is a thing they did in the first episode. They did it for the first couple episodes and they drop it very quickly because they should. It's very awkward and it stops the show in its tracks.
Yeah, I think it's because it's a, as the first one was, it's very novelistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's like the thing I was just like, let's, is it this person? Is it this person? What about this? I'm like,
yeah,
we've been watching for the last 45 minutes, man. How short attention or spans do you think we have?
Yeah.
They waited 2 days to do a background check on Gerald. Like he has all these, he doesn't know who Gerald is, does no background check until 2 days later.
Yeah. I mean, they can't, they get no sense of him from his house. And, why he's there. He has a picture of a wife it's just a wedding picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And they don't think to, like, right away run a background check on him.
Yeah, they did nothing. They did more investigating Mac's flights.
Yeah.
Barnaby sure knows a lot of stuff magically in this episode. He knows the location of the transvestite club.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's gay club. They don't underground. It seems to be an underground mystery club.
Yeah.
I think he just hangs out there every once in a while.
For hookups, I guess, maybe.
He knows Gerald is Liam.
Yeah. Yeah.
He knows that, and he knows Honoria's brother died of AIDS.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where would you even kind of guess that? Except that, he was gay, which
he was gay.
Is
yeah.
kind of not right.
By 1998, you should have gotten past the whole gay plague thinking.
Yes. Yeah. Although we don't really, did they say when he died?
I don't think they say. Because I remember trying to figure that out. And I don't think they ever say. They don't. There are a lot of things that aren't quite as fleshed out as they should have been, other than...
Like, how long has that body been sitting there in that room?
Yeah. Yeah. I think at a certain point,
I thought it was a good thing that Joyce read him the exact passage of the book he would need to solve the case.
That was very convenient. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Joyce, always helpful. What the hell was that scene where, like, they're interviewing Hutton?
Mm-hmm.
And they have glasses of, I guess, port or wine in front of them?
Yeah.
Or sherry?
They usually turn down any kind of libations of the alcoholic sort.
I know, and it's just there. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's a cup of tea. Nah, hard stuff. Yeah. Sherry.
As in the killings of Badger's Drift, they do get a side trip outside of Midsummer. And this time they go to London, which is very rare for them. Mm-hmm. They go to the Royal Albert Hall. To an apartment building, which is actually the Royal College of Music. And so they go up to this suite that overlooks the Albert Hall.
Are you saying Gerald had an apartment at the Royal College of Music?
It was probably the Andrew Lloyd Webber suite that they used. But the important thing is that we now know how many holes it takes to fill the Albert Hall. And that is my Beatles reference for the day.
Did you notice that when Barnaby pulls up to the seaside cottage, he's immediately unbuckling his belt and like trying to open the door before the car stops.
He's eager to get to that body.
Get me out of this car.
Well, we all know how Troy drives.
Oh, God. Another classic Troy driving scene. Yeah. Another classic Troy bad interview scene.
Yeah.
Troy being gross over the bouncing Barbara.
Oh, yeah.
Which, honestly, it feels like someone should have called him out. It's like, if you're going to be creep, if you're going to, like, point out the clapper's kind of gross.
Yeah.
You're calling a woman bouncing Barbara.
Yeah.
It's not cool.
Especially since she doesn't bounce.
Yeah. When she runs up the stairs in the cottage, she didn't bounce.
Yeah.
I was like, well, is she wearing a sports bra to a romantic getaway? That doesn't seem right. Also, Troy was, at that point, even Troy's teachers didn't like him.
Yeah. I couldn't tell if that was a teacher. I mean, he refers to him as Mr. whatever. But he's wearing, I thought he was a janitor because he's wearing like a coveralls.
Yeah, so did I. But I don't know if he was a teacher or what, but he's just like, oh, this one.
Yeah.
Get him out of my property.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit of home life. The whole Barnaby is allergic to cats subplot.
Yep.
I thought that was dumb. not dumb so much as incredibly overacted. And Nettles is a much better actor than this, but the gratuitous scratching and the never, by the way, as someone who has allergies to cats, he would also be, his eyes would be burning. He would be blowing his nose constantly.
Yeah. I have never had an allergy to animals, so I couldn't tell you how authentic it was, but I know that you have and that you have to take.
He was overacting. It was just like, what is this itching? I'm like,
yeah.
And I thought it was terrible because Kilmowski was this just cute little cat who should have been in the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, probably could have kept him. Maybe she did.
I'm sure she did, but it was just it was such a, although she does move back with him periodically and there's no more Kilmowski. So
yeah,
I just thought Kilmowski was super cute and it was been in a really like, it just seemed like they had this allergy bit as like just a joke or whatever, but it was, it's like you, the cat was so cute that it didn't like, it was like, no, I want the cat.
Yeah. We feel that the cat got a bad rap. In other words,
yes. I think it was appropriate that Joyce laughed at him when he said he was allergic.
Yeah.
By the way, so Kilmowski was a Russian blue, as they said in the episode.
Yeah.
So I Googled this. Russian blues don't really shed.
Mm-hmm.
So they are considered more hypoallergenic than other cats. So they are like, you would have like, people with allergies would have less of a problem with them. So my point is, if Tom is this allergic to cats, then any cat should just kill him. Just dead on.
Yeah.
Like he needs to have one of those like epinephrine shots with him at all times.
Yeah. And it never really comes up again. And we do see other cats.
Yeah. It's amazing how they forget things.
Yeah.
And of course, that beautiful closing shot of Kilmowski just licking itself.
Yeah. He does a lot of licking of himself in the episode, which I guess is one way to train a cat to like stay in one place. You put something on them where they will lick themselves.
Yeah. I feel like we talked about Brad when we talked about the actor.
Yeah.
Nettles is super slim in this episode, right?
Yeah, he really is. This is about, 8 years after the end of Bergerac?
Yeah, about there.
Yeah.
About 8 to 10. Yeah.
Because I think it ended in 90. So, yeah. And he was very, very slim. I've seen the shirtless pictures. I watched the show. I know how slim he was in that. We all put on the weight when we get older. It's just.
Oh, yeah. I was just like, wow, he is super skinny in this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you had a question. You wanted to ask?
Well, you know, just at the end, and I think we both know the answer to this, but which of those books would you read?
Kids' book.
If they had all gotten finished.
The only one that would ever have gotten published would have been that kids' book.
Yeah.
Maybe the romance novel, but it would have been like a Harlequin paperback.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, the spy novel might also just been like a paperback, like mass market thing. That play, no one was ever going to see that play again once it was...
That play was never, ever, ever going to see the light of day. And there would have been 100 copies printed of the Lydiard family history, and none of them would have sold because Honoria would have gotten hers for free.
I don't know. They might make good doorstops. and I got to say, that play would have seen the light of day. Once one performance in that school, he would have been fired.
Even without the sleeping with a student.
Oh, God.
A 15-year-old student. Yeah.
So let's final thoughts then. Let's bring this around to final thoughts.
You know, there are a lot of things that I shouldn't like it, but I really do like this episode. I think a lot of it is the acting is really, really good. Anna Massey, for me, anchors this in a way that a really good murderer should anchor a mystery. I like, and I when I was watching it again, I wanted to make sure that the two threads of the two murderers, their stories really worked and were equal, and they were. They both work.
Yes.
I do think they could have like fleshed out a few things a bit more, especially in the resolution, but you know, everybody's dead by then. So, with you know, because I did have all those questions that I brought up about Max, and, you know, was he just basically telling Liam's story as if, you know, as a novel, even though it really happened, and did nobody notice that it was not, that this was a true crime that happened 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of goes to, so like, I think a lot, I think I agree with you. There's a lot of weird stuff in this episode. There's some serious ick, but overall, this is a great episode.
Yeah.
It's the mystery elements are solid and really interesting. Yeah. Some stuff maybe has not aged as well, but that is, you know, we can only look at things like we have to kind of look at through like what the lens was then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think even then it's somewhat progressive, mm-hmm. in Tom's sort of understanding of it.
Yeah. Tom is like, you know, I mean, Troy is the one that, yeah. And both Joy and Joyce and Tom are like, okay, this is the way it is. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
As I said, the Clapper subplot really adds nothing. And I think that it does detract a bit from the elements that we did need more exposition on.
Mm-hmm.
But again, wonderful, like great performance. I say wonderful. It's a wonderful performance that disgusted me completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anna Massey is like, everyone does a really fantastic job in this. And I think it's, you know, I just think it's a really, I think it's a great episode. I think like it's memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember this, like I remember who did it. I remember the ending. I remember mm-hmm. lots of this episode.
Yeah.
Which is not, you know, in a show, like that's not always true with Midsommar. Like sometimes I've forgotten completely who did it.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely one of their better episodes. I just feel like I really could have used a lot less Clapper. I could have used more Honoria. Mm-hmm. I could have used more Clapper in a sense that where he actually looked like he might have been the killer.
Yeah, I think the thing with that, the Clapper subplot, the Brian Clapper subplot, is that he is never a serious suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is no serious suspect. It's kind of like, yeah, it's most likely the crazy woman.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I'm fine with that, because then they give you that twist of, no, the other one is actually Gerald.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But yeah, it's very clear. And then you're like, oh, she's really crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I think there's a reason why everyone loves this episode, and
yeah,
it is the last 15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you really only have two sympathetic characters in here other than Kilmowski. And that is Sue and Amy. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody else has kind of,
I feel a little bad for Laura, yeah. Not Lauren. It's also, she's like, it's kind of her own making.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, although again, we don't ever really see how her relationship is with Gerald. We don't see them outside of the meetings.
Yeah. They should have had a scene together.
Yeah.
You know, he has that scene with Amy, and because he trusts and likes her, we trust and like her.
Oh yeah. By the way, I realized something we were discussing and I forgot to mention it. So he gives Amy £100,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she can basically get away from Honoria.
Mm-hmm.
When was he planning to die? Because otherwise she's got to sit waiting for like she could be stuck there for decades.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, just give her the money, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, but a really good episode. I mean, despite some of our qualms, I think it's just a really, really good episode.
This is a really good episode. But it's interesting, is I will say, to sum it up, as like, it also shows like that kind of where, you know, if Killers of Badger's Drift, Killing of Badger's Drift shows like how great a Midsommar episode could be, right?
Mm-hmm.
This one shows just where the pitfall could be for it to fall, like to fail or to not be a great episode because of the ick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it doesn't quite in this episode, but you can see like if they like 5 more minutes of Clapper, it would have been.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I kind of wish I had a scene of Sue throwing his stuff out on the front door.
Yeah. Like just like, or him getting arrested for sleeping with a 15-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And justice for Kilmowski.
Yeah. The Kilmowski Chronicles.
Yep. There's a spinoff. So that's everything we wanted to talk about. If you have anything you want to discuss about Written in Blood or Midsommar Murders, please feel free to email us at welcometomidsommar@gmail.com. If you want us to use the email in the show, just say so in your email. We're also welcome to Midsommar on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. We're We are also welcome to Midsummer on YouTube, where we've been slowly uploading our old episodes. Please follow us in all these places. And if you like what you hear, I hope you would consider subscribing to us or rating and reviewing us on iTunes or Spotify. That really helps people find us. Tell all your friends about us, because we're going to be back soon with another whole new episode, and we want you to join us again. As we take the road out of Midsummer, we want to thank you all for listening and remind you that in Midsummer, pissing off Honoria Lydiard can be murder.
Yeah, stay out of the guest room.
Welcome to Midsummer is produced by Eric Wisher and Eileen Becker. All clips in this podcast are used in compliance with the U.S. Copyrights Act Fair Use Exception for criticism and commentary. Our logo and podcast art was designed by Smidre. Our theme music is by the infamous Space.